All right.
Or maybe do a clap.
Yeah, there you go. I love the difference in understanding what slap or clap means.
I said snap.
Okay. No, to me, snap means, you know, hey, you motherfucking piece of shit. Like, I snap at you, you know, I get passive-aggressive or I get aggressive. Yeah, well, snapping, yeah, actually, when you think about it, it is also the clicking of the fingers. But before...
Doesn't somebody getting clapped mean somebody being killed?
Or yeah, not shot specifically. I apologize on behalf of English.
No, but
yeah,
but
you
also,
should. You really.
But
should.
Also, when you tell your bros, "Yo, I clapped last night," doesn't mean you killed
someone.
Yeah,
true,
it
true.
Means, you know,
we're referring to the cheeks. Yes,
clapping of the cheeks.
Of which ATs are my favorite. Hold on, we have a guest, guys. Let's show some table manners.
Of course. No, before you start asking the guest any questions, I love that for the first time we actually arguably have the three sexiest accents on planet Earth all gathered here on the podcast, which is all obviously Arabic, but Hakim doesn't sound anything like an Arab. Slavic, I don't sound anything as like a Slav, though. And Swedish. He sounds like a Swede, though. So finally, we get to actually.
Now, y'all wait just a daggum minute. You forgot the best damn accent in the world.
Oh, I baited you and you clapped.
Oh, Lord. I love it.
Lovely.
Hold on. Before we're discussing this, our lovely guest, Thomas, he was telling us about a concept. I'm sorry, what was it again?
People's beer or folköl in Swedish.
Okay. Yeah.
So it's
please enlighten us.
Yeah. So it's originally it's a tax bracket of beer. So it's it caps out at 3.5%. It's usually either 2.8 or 3.5, and you can actually get it at the store rather than the state monopoly.
Which tell our viewers a bit about that. To me, like, that is the ultimate dystopia. Like, Sweden sounds like a great country, except that thing. Probably, y'all are healthier or whatever. But tell our viewers about, you know, how rigid the alcohol system selling there is or whatever.
Before you get to that point, I just want to say that I think it's absolutely based. And it's, you know how Marcus Lance talk about the withering away of the state? Well, I think of the withering away of alcohol.
Of the liquor store.
And slowly but surely... Slowly but surely, it's this is the dictatorship of the proletariat stage of getting rid of alcohol. It's the state monopoly. Sorry, go on.
Tell us about people's beer and how this horrible system, no matter what this Sharia-inducing Hakim wants to tell you.
Well, Hakim may be, what's the word? He may be dismayed biased to learn that it's actually a good system and it makes the alcohol cheaper.
Oh, then rip me.
Yeah. So what they have is basically anything above 3.5% has to be sold in the state monopoly, the state alcohol monopoly, and because they are such a big actor, they get huge discounts because you know they're buying for the entire country. Some you know things like vodka is quite expensive, but things like wine and beer is you know moderately priced.
Interesting.
And I think this is the case in let's see, it's Finland has Alko, Norway has Vinmonopolet. I don't know about Denmark, but at least these around the Baltic and Norway, all three have the same kind of system. But yeah, you're not allowed to sell it at the store, let's say, and the opening hours are quite strict. They're not allowed to sell cold beer at the Monopoly.
Uh-huh.
Yes. Or the
how does that work? I thought the only way you could drink beer is cold. I don't know.
That's
intentional,
so you don't drink immediately.
The idea is they're not supposed to encourage you to go in, you know, buy cold beer and drink it immediately. But the law isn't written like that. The law says that they either have to sell all of it at like room temperature or all of it cold. But I know of none of these stores, Systembolaget it's called, none of these stores have fridges.
And then folköl is when people create beer that is under what you have to sell in the state monopoly as alcohol, quote unquote. So they make the low alcohol beers, and that's what you can buy in like a normal grocery store and stuff. Is that how, am I understanding it right?
Yeah, it's 3.5%, and I believe it's only beer. So wine and what's known as spirits, basically it has to be made from grain.
Yeah.
Otherwise, it's either wine or alcohol, just a generic. Even if it's 3.5%, it's kind of...
All right. Is there Swedish, like, grain-based, like, just traditionally Swedish grain-based alcohol?
Well, I mean, you have beer, of course, but if you're looking at, let's say, a malt-based drink, you may be looking at svagdricka.
Mm-hmm.
It's quite similar to kvass, actually.
Yeah.
Ah, okay. Mm-hmm.
And there's non-alcoholic kvass that's nice, Hakim, if you haven't tried it.
I've heard, yeah. I've heard. I remember in, what's it called? I remember the first time I encountered kvass was in the movie, the Soviet movie, Kidnapping Caucasian Style, which is a fantastic film that I highly recommend everybody watch. It was shot in Crimea. It's a beautiful, beautiful movie. But I remember, yeah, you see these, like, you know, basically kidnapper dudes, and they just huddle around this thing. And they down this fucking, and they make it look like it's the most delicious thing on earth. I was like, hey, you know what? Maybe they got a point. But yeah, but no, hold on. Cause again, I know that I don't know shit about alcohol. I just know that some national spirits or hard liquor is usually like potato based or other kind of root vegetable or something like that based. Isn't rakia basically like this, Jakubnik, or is that fruit based?
Yeah, that's mostly fruit based, but you're completely right. Usually, the development of traditional alcoholic beverages was directly linked to whatever type of fruit, vegetable, or grain they created in surplus on average.
Yeah.
So they wondered what to do with the surplus. And most of the time, the extremely pragmatic thing to do is create alcohol. Probably even originally, certain alcohols were developed in those particular regions when you would store a shit ton of, for example, plums, and some of them would literally get so old that they would ferment. And somebody was probably like crazy enough to be like, "Oh, let's try this fermented stuff." And all of a sudden, oh my god, it has a funny effect on my head. And then it continued, etc., etc. No, actually, ironically, the original. What we know as the originator of alcohol is actually from your beautiful people, specifically around the region of Syria, Iran, and Iraq, actually. But it was originally developed quite literally as an antiseptic, for cutting off limbs, cutting off fingers, etc. So doctors from your region invented the poison that you despise through the bottom of your soul. So you see the beautiful karma of the world. But what's extremely interesting, and obviously we're going to cover to a great extent in this incredible episode that we have prepared for you, is because it is state run and state organized, in the long run it actually ended up being cheaper for the everyday consumer in case of obviously the Nordics and the selling of alcohol. Probably if that same system is maybe applied to other consumables, maybe we would see the same result. Who said that competition leads to lower prices? As cliche as it is.
You're getting dangerously close to calling for nationalization of core industries. You're being sound like a communist. No, my question, just because again, the one thing that I know of, because you mentioned an interesting point of it being the relevant thing that's grown in the area that's in surplus. In Iraq, we have something called arak, which is basically the date distilled, date syrup or dates with mixed with yeast and water, whatnot, then it's distilled. And it's like a hard spirit that some people drink. Wondering, does Sweden have anything like this specifically? Like the traditional hard liquor or spirit that's just a Swedish thing?
No, I would say Sweden is part of the vodka belt, so it would be vodka.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, before you obviously have various fruit wines and stuff and beer, but it's only with the arrival of the potato, and it's even such that Swedes don't like potatoes when they first arrive from the New World until they figure out they can make alcohol from them. This leads to huge societal problems. You have a temperance movement in Sweden popping up in the 1800s. Swedish had a referendum on banning alcohol in the early 1900s, like the 1910s. And it was very close. It was 50-something to 40-something.
Wow. Very based. Very based.
That's also,
I'm just saying this to piss you off.
We see the 1920s in the States with, banning even this sort of narcotic, which it is a narcotic.
That's why we have the system we have today. So previously they had a system with rationing as well, like ration coupons. But your ration was determined by A, your sex. So if you were a man, you got a much larger I believe women didn't get any. And if you are part of the aristocracy or the bourgeoisie, you also get a bigger allotment. So, yeah, and they got rid of that because that was deemed, you know, not
cringe.
Cringe, basically, yes.
There was an official referendum, and then it was decided the king established that. It is indeed cringe.
Oh, yeah. We have a king, by the way. For absolutely everyone. Yeah, I know, and he's kind of famous.
Yeah, well, I mean, he's famous for his silly hats.
Exactly.
Honestly.
Especially among them. Absolutely. But not like, probably most people know this, but, you know, Sweden produces arguably one of the most famous vodkas on planet Earth, and one that is sold both in the East and the West massively, which is Absolut Vodka, which also, like, has arguably one of the best branding ever. And funny enough, like, back in the day when it was, like, even more of a hardcore sellout, I worked on, like, advertising campaigns on it, and they sent a few guys over to Sweden to see the factory. And it's apparently a product which is like 100% quote-unquote sustainable. Obviously, it's not sustainable when it comes to the labor exploitation of the people that toil away in its factories. But, you know, even like the gas that is emitted during the production, they like resell to, for example, Coca-Cola to make it sparkly, et cetera, et cetera. It's like a 100% utilized thing, which again leads us to, you know, the conversation that we're going to have later is, oh, maybe if everything is properly planned, adequately systemized, maybe, you know, it can be 100% arguably environmentally sustainable. But, you know.
But what about the shareholders?
What about the shareholders? Yeah.
What about the profit?
Exactly. But yeah, good job on Absolut Vodka, I'll give you that. It's not bad. It's like always, it's like constantly mid. That is very difficult to achieve. You know, it's mid, it's not great, but it's constantly mid. You like never like try it and you're like, oh my God, I'm about to die. You know, it's always fine.
I have a sound clip here for you. The cause of and solution to all of life's problems.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Deep Program. Today we have a very special episode with a fantastic guest. He is a great Swedish comrade and free software enjoyer, as he self-described. Nice. I think a more apt title, and definitely more badass title, is a cybernetic Marxist or cybernetic socialist. He has a lot of interesting work that he writes about, has also made several videos about in regards to economic planning, as well as being basically fairly competent in these spheres, which the vast majority of Marxists, including us on the podcast, basically know dog shit about. We know nothing about it. So I'll hand it off to Thomas. Please introduce yourself and then let people know where they can find you, and you can start with your lovely, lovely intro and presentation.
Okay, right. My name is Thomas Herdin, and I live in Umeå in northern Sweden, so about 60 degrees something north. So I have a blog at herdin.se, H-A-E-R-D-I-N .se, and I write about, especially about planning and mathematics and socialism, and also other things like electronics, but that's perhaps not relevant to this discussion. I also make YouTube videos. Recently started, translating my work for YouTube. I'm also involved in the academic discussion around planning.
Which is beyond based, honestly. It's something that's very, very required. It's good that very people impressive. Make videos about this stuff. Yeah, yeah. But it's exceptional that people are actually making basically theory is what it is. But yeah, all the links for anybody interested will be available in the show notes, and of course we'll shout them out again at the end of the episode. Today's episode will be a little bit different. Rather than just kind of bantering throughout the entire episode and questions and discussions back and forth, we thought it'd make a little more sense to have a bit more of a presentation from Tomas, and then we'll pretend to be the audience. We'll interject with our questions throughout to kind of like deepen the analysis and to get more information and more make everything a lot more clear for us as well as for everybody listening at home. So basically, yeah, you're in here for a lecture, okay? It's not all just fun and games. Being a Marxist means math, so no. This is your time to leave the movement.
Yes. I'm afraid we're going to have to do math.
Yeah, exactly.
Everyone, man. This is when I log off.
This social democracy stuff's looking pretty good, guys. Yeah. I'm kidding.
Obviously. I'm going to tell y'all up front, I can count to 6 or 7, but when my teacher put in them letters instead of just the numbers, boy, I tell you what, I almost ran out the room. And now y'all are trying to tell me you need multidimensional polygon. What?
Oh my god. All right, please intro us.
I thought Marxism was just shooting rich people. Jesus Christ. Okay.
Yeah. All right, we're done.
Okay, we're done. Apologies, sir.
Right, so our listeners might be asking themselves, like, what is planning even? And it may surprise them to learn that they have probably encountered a form of planning in a virtual world, which are a lot of video games, especially strategy games and the like, where you have to gather resources. In, for example, StarCraft, you have to gather mineral and gas. You don't have like money in there, and you have to sort of household with these resources in order to reach your goal. Of course, the goal in StarCraft is to crush your enemy rather than having a functioning and sustainable and, you know, good society. But still, video games provides like a concrete example of planning, because you're seldom, well, some games are, of course, have money internally, but a lot of them are just in terms of just the resources. So, for example, workers and resources, Soviet Republic. So I thought I'd begin with asking a rhetorical question here, which is, what is planning? And planning is calculation in kind. So it is calculating in terms of physical goods to organize your economy rather than relying on exchange. So this means that you run your economy in terms of, you know, number of planks of wood of a certain dimension, number of boots, number of cans of beer, and the role of money or means of payment, if it even has a role, is primarily secondary.
I would like to just make a comment on that. It's a point that Cockshot's made in his video on in how exactly the USSR was socialist, and he specifically mentions this point in that money was not a direct indicator of your ability to attain goods, insofar as production wasn't linked to market mechanisms. It was linked to a plan. So there's no major supply and demand aspect there. And what that meant is that it doesn't really matter how much money you have. That doesn't translate to you being able to go and buy up more stuff. So again, yeah, exactly. It's a secondary role, which is kind of a step towards, you know, decommodification, if you even want to word it that way. Go on.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. Like it's you can choose what kind of means of payment you have in the system. And we can get to that point later. So the second rhetorical question we could ask is, why planning? One reason is that a planned economy cannot crash. Mm. In a planned economy, you do not have a business cycle. You don't have a cycle of recession followed by a galloping market followed by another recession and so on. But instead, you can sort of know roughly where the economy will be in, you know, 5 or 10 or possibly even 100 years. You know that it's stable. Another thing that you can do is you can introduce explicit environmental constraints. You can say that, for example, we should ensure that carbon sequestration is greater than the emissions, so that we're pulling carbon out of the atmosphere rather than putting it into the atmosphere. Finally, we can choose to have either a shortage economy, like in the Soviet Union, it's quite notorious for this, or you can have a surplus economy where you deliberately produce more than it's actually necessary, or you can try and, you know, do something kind of in between.
Yeah, could you elaborate a little bit on that point? Because a lot of the, or just like a quick addendum, right? Because a lot of the common perceptions of chronic shortages in the USSR, they're not real. There was the 3 points, the early period, of course, where there was barely no planning. World War II, which is understandable, and the end of the Soviet Union, which in which they start introducing market mechanisms. And there was, of course, direct sabotage and whatnot. It's a very long story there. But those are the major periods where there were shortages of goods. But otherwise, I'm assuming what you mean is that Soviet planning for production was more made so that you didn't produce above everything that's required, you produce that what is required, and sometimes that would fall underneath, which would result in a shortage. And that's a way of kind of saving materials in the end. I'm assuming that's what you're referring to.
Yeah, there is a bit of a tension between, say, if you want to maximize the growth of your economy, then you're going to want to run up as close as possible against the production constraints. So let's say you want to maximally utilize your steel production capacity. This can give you really good growth in industries that depend on steel. But as soon as there's any kind of disturbance, and this could be like anything, like you, I don't know, it, someone's sick one day,
natural
or whatever.
Disaster or something.
Yeah, natural disaster, or just, I don't know, a problem in the rail network or whatever. Such problems can tend to amplify themselves, and you can get compounding problems if you make it too stiff. So there is a kind of a, you have to weigh it against these things against each other, basically.
Balancing game. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a balancing act between these contradicting sort of interests. So I thought I'd talk a little bit about the history of planning. If we start with Marx and Engels, they are not super explicit about this. Especially Marx, he suggests that it might be possible, I believe, in the critique of the Gotha program. But it's very sort of, it's not very concrete. Engels, on the other hand, gets more explicit with this in Socialism, Utopian, and Scientific. Like, he makes, for example, comparisons to the alkali trusts in England, I believe, where they basically organize production. They conspire to organize production between each other, sort of like, you do this much, you do that much, the kind of stuff that happens in a monopoly. And he kind of sees that, like, wait a minute, couldn't workers do the same thing? Like, there seems to be a possibility here to have a deliberate action in the economy. He makes a comparison between the organized nature of the trusts compared to the anarchy of the market. So the sort of chaotic production in the market, where you're going from an overproduction to underproduction, back into overproduction, and so on. Compared to these cases where even the capitalists amongst each other deliberately sort of plan what to do. But even with Engels, this is not very developed. He also kind of, he gets a little bit more concrete with it, but it's still sort of abstract. We might want to explain to the listeners here the one fundamental difference here is, in a planned economy, you're talking only in terms of use values rather than exchange values. So that's Marx and Engels. Where this starts getting concrete is with Otto Neurath, who was an Austrian socialist. He was involved in the Austro-Hungarian war economy. So what Austria-Hungary does before the Great War breaks out is they establish something called the War Preparedness Acts of like 1910, 1911, where the state reserves the right to basically expropriate any means of production necessary in case of war. So this is what Austria-Hungary does in 1914 when war breaks out. And Neurath is employed in this system that arises in the so-called war centers, or the Kriegszentralen. And they run an in-kind economy during the war. And the reason is, as Neurath puts it, you win war using bullets and bombs and bread and not money. After the war, what Neurath suggests is that you can potentially use a similar system, but for peaceful ends. So instead of producing bullets and bombs, let's produce cake and boots and whatever. He puts this idea forward in the short-lived Bavarian Soviet Republic in 1919 to 1920, roughly, which is also something like people people don't really know about. There was a Soviet Republic in Europe, in Central Europe. Yeah. Unfortunately, it
Hungary,
got crushed
Bavaria,
by
Slovakia.
Bavaria, that's south of southern Germany.
Yeah, yeah,
and
it, exactly.
Yeah, and of course
exactly
after
like it, but there are other Soviets.
Oh yeah, of course. I mean, Soviet in this case is just a workers' council, and then you know a Soviet yeah republic is more like an amalgamation of workers' councils. Mm. But basically, they have a revolution in Bavaria after the Great War, and unfortunately, the Social Democrats do what Social Democrats do, and they crush it. Same goes, of course, for...
Call me surprised.
Yeah, call me surprised, exactly. And they do the same, of course, notably with Liebknecht and Rosa Luxemburg, as we all know. So that is unfortunately basically destroyed in, I believe, 1921. So Neurath goes in, let's say, polemic in favor of this idea. He starts agitating for this idea. And he then meets resistance from what will later be known as the Austrian School of Economics. And what the Austrian School of Economics is a reactionary far-right school in economics. It's basically founded by a guy called Ludwig von Mises. And later you get a guy called Friedrich Hayek. And basically their entire point, the entire argument that they put forward is a reply to Neurath. So that's where the Austrian school sort of is born, let's say. What the Austrians say is, in short, you cannot run an economy without exchange. You cannot run an economy without the market. And the argument, I'm not sure if we have time to go into the details of it, but effectively what they're saying that if you can't compare like the prices of different things, then you can't decide what to choose in your company. And it's also things like, well, the goal of the company is to make profit, so you're not going to buy, you know, crazily expensive things to produce your output because your consumers are not going to buy it if you buy too cheap inputs. That's sort of the argument that they're making, and Neurath is countering this. However, at the same time, things are, of course, happening in the Soviet Union, or what will become the Soviet Union. Following the success of the Russian Revolution, I believe it is Lenin that quickly deduces that what they have to do to basically not be crushed is they have to get the industrial base up and running. And in order to get that up and running, they have to electrify the entire union. And from this, we have the slogan, communism is Soviet power plus the electrification of the whole country. And as part of this, they create an initiative, I think would be the right word here, called Goelro. It's the effort basically to electrify the entire union. And this in turn gives birth to what becomes known as Gosplan. This is in 1920 that Gosplan is founded, and it is as a result of, let's say, the problems they have during electrification. So they realize that they have to organize this somehow, and they don't really know how to, because there is no theory on this stuff at this time. It's basically Neurath's ideas, but I don't think the Soviets know about them at this time. It's happening at the same time, obviously. It's 1919, 1920, 1921. But that's when Gosplan is founded. A couple of months, I believe, after Ludwig von Mises goes out and says that planning cannot be done, then they do rapid industrialization. The Nazis invade, the Soviet Union crushes the Nazis, they put the first man in space. So for the longest time, it was basically considered that von Mises was wrong. Clearly, you can do planning. I mean, if the Soviet Union couldn't have done planning, they would have been destroyed even before the Nazis invaded, like in 1928 mm-hmm. or whatever. But it clearly worked, and worked for, 70 years? 71 years, I believe. So that's kind of the view in the Soviet Union. And this system that they have, it runs on like pen, paper, adding machines. I believe they use the telegraph. What I know is that they're sending like physical papers around in briefcases. Mm. So it is sort of kind of slow, and there is no way to sort of automate the system. There is some attempts to computerized planning in the Soviet Union over the years. It kind of starts in the 60s. They start looking into this, and it makes some headway. That's an entire story unto itself, let's say. So basically, at the same time that they're discussing computerizing planning in the Soviet Union, you also have election success in Chile, where you have Salvador Allende coming into power. And under him, you have a guy called Fernando Flores. And he's wanting to do planning in Allende's Chile as well. But they would like to do this using this newfangled invention called the computer. Or by this time, it's not that newfangled. I mean, it's 1970s. So they bring in a British like management consultant called Stafford Beer. And he has some ideas around this. And this is kind of the era when sort of cybernetic management is taking hold. And he's helped a lot of companies fix their slow internal coordination to be able to adapt more quickly to the changing reality. So what they do is they found a system called CyberSyn. And this is a system that runs on a couple of computers. It's something like 3 computers. They don't have very many of them. And they have a bunch of teletypes that they connect to them. So it's like a teleprinter. So at a workplace, you can sort of type in production numbers, if there's a problem, things of that nature. And it's very experimental at this stage. And unfortunately, due to the coup in 1973, this is, of course, entirely scrapped as soon as what's-his-face comes to power, Pinochet.
He threw the project out from a helicopter.
Yes, he threw it from onto the ground. Oh.
Into the sea. Oh, yeah, okay.
Yeah, exactly. But basically, there is at this time, roughly the 70s and 80s, there is this idea that we could computerize planning and thereby both make it a lot faster. You could also have more direct input from workers, things that we kind of expect with how the internet is so pervasive today. Mm-hmm. We expect to be able to talk very directly to each other, not have to send, you know, letters in the mail and so on. But it's, of course, the Soviet Union is dissolved in 1991, I believe. Kazakhstan is the last country standing. Hence why it's the best country on earth.
Absolutely. My Kazakhstan friends listening to this and taking it unironically and then telling me that they are best country in the earth, in the earth for the next like 5 years. Thank you very much for that.
But and also really tragically, I learned this recently, is that the system that they're trying to build in the Soviet Union, and they have some success with, this is like Viktor Glushkov is trying to do this. What's initially called ASPER and later OGAS. This system is actually used to speed up the shock doctrine in the Soviet Union. So they use this.
Oh my god!
Yeah. They use this computerized system to help with the privatization of the entire the entire state sector. It's absolutely crazy.
Either way, this shows that you can plan your way to basically ruining an economy as quickly as possible.
It's expedient, that's for sure, in both directions.
Yeah, the 90s in the former Soviet Union, and especially in Russia, is absolutely horrifying. If you talk to any Russian who lived through it, it's like, yeah, no. Mm.
Exactly right.
The entire thing just... And it worked, especially you look at the numbers. I mean, the growth slowed down in like under Brezhnev, but it's not like it was crashing. It was functioning.
Yeah.
It's only like after 91, it's completely like GDP halves in 1 or 2 years. Like absolute. The free market. So fantastic.
Exactly right. It found a way.
Yes.
Found a way to basically divert everything that people built towards a thin sliver of basically criminals, black market criminals.
And it's like, I love how like they say, but not later the line went up, but they can no longer even say this now because the line went up and then war, just like every post-socialist internationalist effort, once it's turned into capitalism, leads to physical conflict as well. So you have the economic crash and then literally ex-brothers blowing each other's brains out on the field. Fucking
exactly
beautiful.
Yeah. For people interested in this Yugo Kney has a fantastic video he made on decommunization and consequences. He made, I believe, with Balkan Odyssey. JT has a fantastic video on post-Soviet Russia, and I also have a pretty decent one on modern Russia and the shift and whatnot. So there is material out there. You guys can go and check and read through all our sources, educate yourselves. But sorry, Thomas, it's all very interesting to learn about the history. But how does modern planning look like? What can people learn about today and then actually put into practice for the future? What is that looking like, this sphere?
Right. So as the listeners are aware, there is basically no planning outside of the DPRK at the moment. And how that system works is anyone's guess. We don't have very much information about this, which is unfortunate. It will be interesting to see how they actually do it. But that's a very good question, actually. How do they... Okay, well, we can look at, for example, some of the criticisms that are levied against the possibility to even do planning. So that's where some of the progress is being made today. That's where a lot of my work is focused.
Yeah, exactly that. Tell us more about your work and your perception of how all of the advancements in tech, et cetera, and math, et cetera, can be used to create a... more productive planned economy than what was done before, or like a planned economy which might actually work very, very well.
Okay, so we can start with how it works in the Soviet Union and the extent to which Gosplan could actually plan. And the answer is it was quite limited. It's limited to certain strategic goods, a couple of thousand. I believe it's on the order of 10,000 goods. And it's, things like steel, the rail system,
coal,
electricity, stuff like those stuff.
What important they could, but boring stuff.
I mean, that's
exactly right.
What they couldn't plan are things like the entire light industry sector, what they call sector B, I believe they call it. They have sector A and sector B, and all they can really do in sector B is plan things in terms of rubles. And of course, if you get a allocation from Gosplan saying you should produce clothes for this many rubles, you're obviously going to produce the most expensive clothes, not the clothes people want. This is sort of the one of the problems that they have, kind of a weird thing where they don't really have the computational power, again, because they're doing this with pen and paper for a very long time. It's only near the end that they start to computerize. And in the mid-1980s, you have a guy called Alec Nove who further cements this notion that planning is not possible by saying that because the number of products in the Soviet Union was on the order of, I believe, 12 million, and because solving a linear system in 12 million equations requires, 12 million to the third power, so that would be, 10 to the 6, 10 to the 18... 1,000 billion computations. Mm-hmm. Then his point is, and also the Austrian's point is that this is not possible. And even with electronic computers, they say this is not possible. But then people like me come around, and even at this time, there are some computer scientists who know that actually this is bullshit. You can solve the linear equations this big. We actually do it every day. And it's around this time that Paul Cockshott and Alan Cottrell releases they start writing, and then in 1991, I believe, they release Towards a New Socialism, where they directly attack this notion. And this is with 1990s computer equipment. So if we can sort of take so what Gosplan is actually doing, they have maybe 10,000 goods. Alec Nove says that you would have to do 10 million goods and this cannot be done. And you have a Cockshott and Cottrell saying, yes, you can. And what I've been doing is showing that, yes, you can do it with, 12 million. That's not a problem. What's really interesting is how far can you push it? And the current estimate I have is that you can do this for 100 billion different production methods. And that's on a single...
Which is more than any... which is more than any modern sophisticated economy at this point, really.
Well, you can think of it in terms of, say you have a number of workplaces, right? So I don't know how many might we have, 100 million workplaces worldwide, let's say. We could then make space in the system for 1,000 production methods per workplace. So you might have different kinds of shoes that you can make, or you can make them in different ways, or all that kind of stuff. So you want to collect all that in a single system, and by doing that you can sort of get each workplace to cooperate directly. You don't have to go via your, you know, your regional planning office and then up the Gosplan and then down again and wait several months.
Take the elevator.
Yeah. Bring your briefcase with you, which they actually apparently did, according to Red Plenty. You can do sort of a horizontal organization there.
There you go. Exactly. Could you give us like a general overview of how you see a planned economy utilizing all the tech we currently have, potential future tech, utilizing all the different systems, et cetera, et cetera? Just introduce our audience to how planning could work and how you would do it if you had the opportunity to do so.
So perhaps we should start then. Let's imagine, you know, a typical work day. You're the average worker here in a, maybe you have, I don't know, 20 colleagues or 100 colleagues, and you have an idea of a thing you want to make, or let's say you have a better idea of how to make anything, like cutting lumber or whatever. So you go on your computer and you log into the system, the global planning system, and you set up like, okay, I have an idea, and you put in your estimate for sort of, okay, how much raw material would we need to make this, and how much could we make per hour, let's say. We've done a little bit of experimentation. You submit this to the system, and the system goes, yeah, we could use this. And you can kind of get like, okay, these people nearby would be able to supply you with raw materials, and these other people would like your thing. So that's kind of one thing, one way to look at it. Yeah, you might have idea, like if you want to start, I don't know, if you want to start a pub or a restaurant, let's say. Okay, well, we're going to need some cooks. We will need various kinds of foods, and this is going to change. But we kind of know in advance how much we will be wanting. So we could kind of pre-order things from the system and be like, okay, we want to have, you know, potatoes delivered this day and, I don't know, eggs the other day. And then we kind of have a rough idea how many people might be interested in this locally. And that could also be a thing, like we want to start up a new workplace, let's say, because we have a suspicion that people will want this. And of course, you would have to then kind of convince, there will inevitably be like a political system on here, which even at today, like if you want to start a business, you have to convince the bank to give you a loan to buy the equipment.
Yeah, and get the permits and everything else.
Yeah. So you can imagine like a similar process where, okay, we have an idea, me and my buddy, we want to have a
Funko Pop manufacturing.
Okay, Funko Pop manufacturing. Yes, we're gonna need a lot of soy, a lot of plastic, a lot of IPAs, of course. So that's kind of the rough discussion. I mean, it's very hard to get too specific about this, because that's let's say you have all these various workplaces that are sort of from day to day, they get deliveries, they scan the deliveries, you have like a barcode on the delivery, it goes into the system, it checks off that it arrived. You might discover that, oh, we suddenly need a thing, and you kind of order it, but other things you might need know in advance. This all gets collected. You have a big old, like a solver that works out where, when, and what needs to go at every point in time. And you can sort of, you know, assuming that people work roughly according to this suggestion, we might call it, then things should actually turn out that way. Like you kind of have to assume that the numbers you have in your computer are of course not the actual reality. It's just a map, it's not the terrain.
So there's a human element to it, but obviously the computer will do the calculations which we not necessarily were able to do back in the day manually when state planning was attempted. But okay, this is super interesting on how from the perspective of an organization which wants to set something up in order to contribute to the local socialist economy would do it. But how would the for the lack of a better term, the central planning committee or the, AI computer, which does the planning or whatever you, or the cybernetics lab or whatever you want to call it. How from their perspective do they utilize all the information points, all the algorithms, et cetera, in order to properly plan an economy in a much more sophisticated, better, faster, et cetera, manner than it was attempted before? And obviously, the direct answer is obviously everything is much faster and much more direct. And because everybody can connect and tap into the system, they can feed the information of what is happening at the local level from down upwards into the system. But obviously, I'm talking as a complete amateur, as the kids would say, noob, unbased, ungoated. But please, how would it look like from the perspective of the system which is planning? Because now we learn how it looks like from the bottom up. Well, how would it look like from the view on top, quote unquote?
Well, I'm kind of the thing that we're gravitating towards, me and my colleagues, like mostly David Zachariah and recently Luca Hagberg. You would set up the system, and the role of the center, let's say, is to make sure that the system works primarily. Or you could say that you have a technical side and then you have a political side. And there's, of course, they're going to overlap to an extent. But you kind of want, or our point anyway, is that you want problems to resolve themselves as locally as possible. You don't really want to bother like your regional political organization, whatever you might call it. It might be your regional Soviet or whatever you call it. You kind of want those decisions that are taken there to be more general, because obviously people can't like decide over every little detail. So if you say in terms of like on the technical side, let's say, you have things like, okay, you have to ensure that the data can come in and that the computed allocations can flow back out again, and that this process works. You want to make sure that all the computers are working, you have backups, you have some way to distribute this so it works. So that's one side of this. The other side is, of course, you will have to have a political body that makes certain decisions that apply to everyone. And these will have to be very, very general decisions. So things like environmental constraints, for example. You would have to make an actual decision like how much carbon dioxide are we going to have in the atmosphere by 2050? What you can do then is you can feed this into the system, and the system can give you a yes or no answer as to whether that is actually possible. Mm-hmm. So that is kind of, if you set up the technical side of it correctly, then the political side gets much easier, because you can just directly ask these kinds of questions like, okay, how quickly can we get the climate situation under control?
And you would know, like, these are to a certain level of clarity, you would know if we choose this particular policy in this particular direction, this is what the results are going to be. If we choose an alternative, this is what the results are going to be. And even more importantly, once you input whatever decision you have made using the information and data that you've received from the system, it will then do better at planning the direction in which you want to go when it comes to, the feedback loop that it gives back to the citizens, the laborers, the working class, et cetera, et cetera. Am I getting that right? Right?
Roughly. So, I mean, you could get really non-intuitive answers out of the system, we have to keep the environment under control. So one thing that it might figure out is like, okay, those guys that are working with, petrochemicals, they can shorten their work week by 15 hours. They can just go home and we can pay them just to stay home or whatever. Then it'll still sort of make sense. It's internally coherent, let's say. within a certain, you know, you have to always assume that there is some inaccuracy in the data, but you know, within a certain percentage, it'll be fine. So that's why we are especially adamant about, you have to separate the planning, the allocation of resources, and kind of the system might suggest new jobs to people who are looking for jobs, that those kind of things. Those you will want to separate from the actual means of payment. So that's kind of a, you can choose to pay people to stay home, but you have to sort of make sure that everything balances out, all the work hours, for example, balance out in the end. So there is a bit of politics that gets in there that the system cannot really deal with. It can only like make suggestions, and then you have to, you know, at some level make a decision somewhere.
So I, and I'm sure a lot of our audience, probably have a difficult time kind of conceptualizing how exactly things get planned on a technical level. So I was watching some of your videos before this chat, and you broke it down, like the actual method of determining the plan with an equation, S times X is greater than or equal to D. So I understand that X is the plan, correct? So how exactly do you go about, you know, determining those variables? So you're sitting down at your machine, what do you plug in? How do you start the process of creating a plan?
Right. So you need two things. So one is you need the what are called the technical coefficients. So you need to know how things are made. So, you know, the ingredient lists that go into your Funko Pops, you know, mm-hmm. you need the paint, you need the plastic, all that stuff. And you can work that out, yeah. you know, a priori, or you can do statistics. So that's the left-hand side of the system. That's the S matrix, as I've labeled it. And then on the right-hand side, you have demand. So you would want to measure or ask people, or, you know, you have a pre-order system, for example, or a local store, all these kind of data sources, let's say, that feed into the system roughly what people's demands are, hopefully as accurate as possible. So that's why you might want to have a pre-order system, like a kind of an Amazon system. You put in, you know, a mail order. That would be great, because then the earlier you put it in, you're like, okay, in 3 months I want this, the better the system can accommodate you.
I would like to also add one bit, which is in deeper literature on this stuff, but AI would be a very big aspect of this as well. So that prior to the most difficult period of a planning setup will be the first couple of months, basically, and after which you can have a directed AI system set up in which all these orders come in and out at regular intervals, and it measures them, and then it will be able to, as the data grows, make basically incredibly accurate assessments predictions of what happens when, where, etc. Along with this, you'd have a direct system of feedback from individual communities. You can have consumer co-ops, you can have it from stores, etc., etc. And all these different accounting systems would also feed into some overarching, basically, planning body, which of course can be democratically organized, horizontal, blah, blah, blah. This is a discussion for another time. But the point being is that there is the idea of it being like something that you have to know that you want lettuce 3 months from now isn't exactly the point I think Thomas is trying to make, or most planning advocates are trying to make. But more, this is more appropriate, for example, in grand planning. For example, let's say you're trying to plan the building of a new city. But this is me getting ahead of myself. I just want to add the nuance. Please go on.
If we just go back to the previous thing here. So you have your left-hand side, you have your matrix there, and you have your demand. So what the solver does is it figures out a vector X that we can call a vector of allocations, or we could call it the plan. And this, anytime the left-hand side or the right-hand side changes, and they do change whenever you put in new data into the system. So whenever you buy a sack of potatoes at the store, it changes things a little bit, and then these allocations also change a little bit. And you want this to be quick, because you know if this takes a year, then you obviously things are going to get very, it'll be very different, difficult to keep the system together. And that side is like, that's the purely computational side, and that that is a very straightforward, relatively straightforward problem. It uses what's called linear programming, and this is basically it's linear algebra, and computers are very good at linear algebra. We have an entire department here at the university that does linear algebra on like computer clusters. That's sort of the easy bit of it, so how you compute the thing. So what I'm more recently saying is that the more tricky thing is all the human elements, all the political stuff, and how do you get people involved in the system? Because we can work all the math out, but the politics, that's a lot more difficult. Mm.
So assuming that we can get everyone, you know, roughly on the same page, everyone realizes, oh, this makes it a lot easier to run my business. You're leveraging this tremendous amount of data that's flowing into your computational systems, and you've got the math and sorted out. In one of your videos, you state that one of the goals is to make planning accessible to everyone. How exactly would that work? Because to my understanding, the machines required to run these kind of calculations are tremendously powerful. Like I'm here and I edit 8K raw video on a machine with 64 gigs of RAM, but I believe the machines you guys are working on are what, you know, multiple terabytes, 3 terabytes of RAM, something like that. So would it be accessible to the average person? Would everyone need a special machine installed from some kind of, you know, central planning machine building committee? How exactly would that work?
Oh yeah, that's a very good question. So it is a bit of an open question to what extent you can distribute these computations. So what I've been having like a rather simplified view of the I'm just assuming, okay, we have one or more computers in tight, you know, they're physically located close to each other, so you can connect them with actual proper networks. But even a modern, like a computer with, like my laptop has 60 gigabytes of RAM, that's enough for at least 10 million variables. Like,
okay,
it's you can do a lot with even relatively modest hardware. But the tricky thing is you kind of don't want to have to make the investment of the actual machine. Oh, right. I figured out actually a very a lot easier. Just pretend it's in the cloud. So you have like a planning cloud, and you, let's say you log into a front end over your web browser, and it just, you know, it takes care of all the heavy lifting for you. And you could, you know, you could make sure you have a regional backup system for this, and you can do like, because there will be a problem, like everyone cannot log into the exact same computer at the same time, like a billion people on the same computer, that's going to be difficult. But you could imagine, you know, you have a municipal little cluster of 100 computers, that's not inconceivable. And maybe you log into that and you do, you know, you make a rough thing, it maybe in a week it gets synchronized centrally, and then, you know, but that's perhaps overly technical.
Okay, so we wouldn't require, you know, supercomputers tied into each business, right? We could have fairly modest hardware that would all be able to communicate on fairly standard networks, and then all that information would be aggregated and fed into a presumably larger machine that would run the more important nationwide side.
Yeah, it has the access to the cloud. Between everyone, right?
I think it's better. The cloud metaphor is better. Just kind of pretend that it's just there.
Yeah, yeah.
Because we can do that. But then there are things like, okay, you want to make sure it's resilient, so you don't want to have it completely tied down to literally a single data center that someone just goes with a pair of scissors and cuts the power.
Right.
But so that can be sorted, and there's all kinds of systems you can look at that are similar in this, that do kind of distribute the computation. You have like folding at home, cryptocurrencies are kind of a distributed computation things. So that's why I say like the technical side, that can be solved. That's not a huge problem. The bigger problem is the political and the sort of the human protocols. The digital protocols, that's relatively easy, let's say.
Well, on the political side of things, we already have, even in, you know, hyper-capitalist countries like the United States, you have a lot of large businesses that rely on some form of planning, right? Like Walmart and Amazon presumably use some form of planning to make sure that, you know, their distribution and production chains remain efficient. Is that, you'd say that's some form of planning as well, right?
Yes, they actually have really, really sophisticated internal planning. And this actually goes for every single company in capitalism is planned internally. So you don't have, you know, your HR department haggling with your engineering department or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
They're all you know, working towards a common goal. And that is perhaps another way to look at this is, you try to view the world as a single workplace. I believe Lenin makes this point. He views the entire Soviet Union as a single workplace. Maybe Hakim knows about this.
Yeah, essentially. I mean, it depends on what point you're referring to, but post NEP for sure, it's supposed to be considered, at least with the state monopoly on all the major industries, supposed to be considered as one large workplace, and that's why the planning aspect is considered to cover every aspect, every section of the economy.
Yeah, because if you don't do planning, you have to fall back to exchange.
And that's why there was exchange between the country and the state in the realm of cooperatives, because at that era you still had, you know, peasantry, and you didn't want to forcefully incorporate them into the state. So they want to slowly turn them into basically like an industrial proletariat of an agricultural form, or agricultural laborers, instead of basically cooperatives who own their own land. It gets very complicated and sophisticated, but. Yeah, you're very right, but the nuance is very
deep.
Yeah,
and I believe also in the kolkhoz system is where you find a lot of the light industry, because they're using money as a kind of a, not generalizes, it abstracts a lot of these things, and basically what money does is it just collapses all the information down to a single number. It's like the price of the thing. So you don't capture like the carbon emissions, for example, or you have to price the carbon emissions, but then you're right back to collapsing it into just the price again. You're not actually able to capture the nuance, which is why you want to do planning. Like, because these concepts are a little bit difficult to communicate. You're wanting to do things entirely in terms of use values as much as possible, because that gets at the problems directly. So for example, carbon emissions, we could view that as a use value, let's say. A negative use value, but a use value nonetheless.
Very interesting. I had one question I think that a lot of people who are listening in on this probably also had, and it's, planning is incredibly abstract when you get to the details of it, and when you just want to explain to a layman audience, ends up being just kind of a lot of political talk and not enough, like, quote unquote, economic substance. But that's just because once you get into the nitty gritty details of it, it's just a lot of math, basically. Yeah. And a lot of organizational work. And that's very evident in your work, by the way. That's why I highly suggest people check out your blog and your videos, and they're going to see that it does get very complex, and very interesting. But here's my question. For people who are interested in this, who would like to learn more about this and learn more about the technical aspects of this stuff, how planning is actually done, the math of it, and everything else, is there any books you could recommend specifically, or any courses, for example, that would be helpful for the future for somebody who might want to get into this, etc., etc.?
I don't think there's a course for like the math of planning. You kind of have to look at the literature. You do have some books, like I have Kantorovich, Leonid Kantorovich, who was a Soviet mathematician. He worked a lot on this kind of stuff. So he has a book called The Best Use of Economic Resources. And he goes through how to do like linear programming, for example, I believe he uses a plywood factory as an example, and how to make the best use of the machines you have available, like if you have different kinds of lathes, for example. So that's a very sort of hands-on how these stuff work at a very micro level. But perhaps one way to explain the concept to sort of more lay people is, imagine that instead of buying things, you requisition them. So you're putting in like a requisition order to the system, like, okay, we need this and that and this and that. And, you know, it could be printer paper or whatever. And it just gets sort of added to the cost of your workplace. And it all kind of averages out in the end. So you don't have to worry about all these. Yeah, that could be one way to explain it. Another way could be, again, to point to the chaotic nature of the market and the business cycle and the present situation with the electricity prices in Europe, for example. It, you know, from one day you can have the prices 1.5 euros per kilowatt hour. The next day it's -5 cents. It's ridiculous. And you can kind of go like, okay, yes, you know, we have, you could have an economic system where you have certainty for quite a long time. You know that as long as there's no natural disaster, and even if there's a natural disaster, you know that you have reserves of this and that already available. So that could be one way to sort of sell it to the layperson, let's say.
Well, more than selling it, I mean, people are actively interested and want to learn about it. Of course, people know about Cockshott's work toward the new socialism. There's a great book on planning called The People's Republic of Walmart, which covers some aspects of intra-firm planning that's practiced under capitalism, for example, amongst other works. But I'm thinking more along these lines. If you had any novel, suggestions, aside from, for example, Kantorovich's writings?
Well, I mean, it kind of depends on how technical you want to get. You can look at the, for example, the literature on linear programming. It's very deep. And if people want like papers on this, they can get in contact with me. I have a whole bunch. But then, yeah, basically you have to go and look at the actual literature. I have here. Can people hear my printed printed papers on, you know, I typically print them, and I have a whole stack, I don't know, 500 pages of mathematical papers on this stuff. And I'm almost caught up to like 1988 or so.
Wow.
So, well, I mean, you jump around a little bit because these things change.
Yeah,
it's an entire field. Like optimization is an entire field, and you get into like, you could have non-convex planning. You know, how do you handle economics of scale in the system? Because that turns out to be mathematically difficult. How do you plan like capital investments? When do you invest in a new production plant somewhere, and where, and how many of them, and all that stuff? That's a lot more difficult, and that's for more mathematically minded listeners. That might be something to look at as well.
I would also like to add, I remember Cockshott in one of his talks also, he says, like in a very plain language, he says, the math isn't what's missing. We know how to plan even very highly sophisticated and large economies, and we have the technology and all that to do it. That what's currently missing isn't the will or the motivation to plan, really. It isn't the lack of methods. What is missing is modern software for planning. And I want to ask you this, since you also have your hand a bit in software development, what does the future look like for that, in which you could, not only for high level planning, for example, for state, like for governments, but also to democratize planning, so even regular day, everyday people could at least play some role, or at least look directly into how the system is planned, the economy is planned. Is there something software-wise being created, or ideas of it at least?
There are some loose things. Like there's a project called August Demo, written by a Russian guy. But that's not released yet, unfortunately. But I am in contact with him. I forget his name. But if people are curious about that, they can go to ogasdemo.ru, and it'll have information in, well, it's in Russian, so. But he is looking at this. This is why I mentioned, or maybe I didn't mention, the need for a inventory system. Kind of the first step is you need to know what you actually have before you can do anything else. You need to know what you have. You need to be able to register where things are coming in and when things are leaving your warehouse or your workplace or whatever. That's one thing. And try to be able to build statistics. And this doesn't really exist. So that's something that I would be interested in developing. And once you start having that, you can also start putting in these production methods that I mentioned, like all these technical coefficients. You can start putting in like, okay, to make a shoe, we need leather and we need rubber and this and that. And we can make this and that many of them, we think. Or maybe, you know, maybe you put in a, a range that you think you can make. Like, we think we can make between 10 and 20 pairs of shoes per hour, you know, to give the system a little bit of leeway. And that's probably you would want to do over the browser, because everyone has a web browser. It's, you know, it's ubiquitous. So that's probably the way to do it. So, you know, you log into a website, you get an account somehow, I don't know, specify your locality, things like that. But it doesn't exist at the moment. So it would likely take a couple of years to write it, I suspect. But it's not like it's not impossible. You could do it. You could write a thing that takes data from users that they basically the metaphor I've been using is a wiki for production. So, you know, you contribute, everyone contributes their little thing that they're good at, and they know how this area of the economy works, you know, roughly. And you can get kind of comedy of the commons effect, where since everyone has their own little thing that they're good at, so long as you can get the system to coordinate the production between, you know, these workplaces or whatever, you can get a very big, you can start getting economics of scale out of it. You can start getting to where you're actually making better use of the labor power compared to the market. And that's where, you know, that's where the real potential for this lies. But it's a big problem. Like, how do you get people, first of all, to understand the concept and to be interested in it? You have to have a thing that people can actually use, and so on. And that's why I think it'll be important to somehow lead by example, to have some kind of like pilot project or something like that. So that's also what I'm trying to do at the moment, and I'm talking to various people. I don't know how much I can talk about that, but there's a bunch of loose bits that have to be sort of sewn together.
Very, very interesting and very exciting. It's a shame that we can't just keep talking about this forever, because there's many more questions and many more things to delve into. But I guess I can give a very quick summary for anybody who's still kind of not on the fence, but kind of confused by the entire idea. So in general, the idea of economic planning is that we don't want to rule our societies and our economies along the dictates of the anarchy of the market, right? According to basically unpredictable fluctuations, or even worse, fluctuations that could be negatively manipulated by certain actors within the economy in order to basically develop to only benefit themselves, amongst many other things, to get rid of the boom and bust cycles and regular recessions and all the negative sides of market economies. So the idea instead is that you bring in a system which plans basically the vast majority of inputs of an economy. This can be done over several ways. Of course, even the possibility of planning every single thing, there is in not even a too distant future, a possibility of this even being done. But if you want to distill it down to something far more feasible just today, the vast majority, if not all, of minor and major inputs in an economy, for example, steel and gas and coal and nuts and bolts and wooden splinters and whatever else you might need, different forms of plastics, different forms of solutions required in manufacture, all these base ingredients that would then go into making maybe 85 to 95% of commodities, both for heavy industry as well as light industry, all of these can go into a system that directly plans for quantity, quality, duration, as well as timetables for everything that needs to be produced. In the end, what this allows for is, rather than the market and basically not knowing even 2 weeks ahead what the prices of something would be or the availability of something might be, you can institute a plan in which you require a certain set of regular deliveries and regular rates of production, regular rates of extraction of, for example, minerals or whatever else, in order to plan a year ahead, 5 years ahead, 10 years ahead, 20 years ahead, so that major projects and sustained development and stable development can be, well, created over, you know, the time period that you establish. That's what the 5-year plans were of the Soviet Union and China, other countries. But the possibility of computerized planning allows us to do things far more impressive and far more all-encompassing than what was possible with basically just pen and paper, as was done in the Soviet Union. All of this, of course, would allow for things that we saw in previous economies, greater rates of economic growth, less economic waste overall, less environmental damage, as well as better planning entirely for society in regards to education, healthcare, ecology, amongst many other things. And in the end, even the International Climate Conference that recently had stated that 1.5 Celsius rise is basically unavoidable at this point. Even they said, unless there's significant and clear directed planning that occurs on a global scale, so essentially it's the solution that Lenin and then afterwards Stalin, all the people underneath them, had advocated for. So TLDR, planning is good, markets are cringe, and there's a lot of literature that is very fascinating as well as very tiring to read through, because some of it requires competence that is highly specialized. But as with most things, if it's worth it, then you'd learn it, right? Mm. With all that being said, this was a very nice episode. Of course, we'll, inshallah, in the future have other guests as well, Solomon, if you'd like to be back on so that we could discuss these in further details. But for the current time, I think that's enough for today. Thomas, do you have anything that you'd like to shout out in particular? Of course, the things you shout out at the beginning, please do that again.
Yeah, no, I've been posting on casperforum.org, which is a web forum for basically classical political economy for people to exchange questions and ideas. So shout out to the people at the Casper Forum. Also, I've been listening to General Intellect Unit, which is the podcast of the cybernetic Marxists. It's on the Emancipation Network. So shout out to those fine people. But otherwise, yeah, check out my website and my YouTube channel, and feel free to contact me if you have any questions. I wouldn't mind showing up again in the future.
I would definitely love to have you on. Of course, all the links and other things that Tom shout out will be in the description box or the show notes of the episode. With all that being said, this has been the Deprogram. I'm Hakim.
I'm JT.
I'm Yugopnik.
And I'm Tomas Harim. And I'm afraid we're going to have to use math.
Exactly right. No!